Good afternoon. Thanks for being here today. I know you guys have lots of options of sessions to attend. This is my first APHA, so I was a little bit overwhelmed at the program brochure, but I'm glad to see you guys here. I am from Virginia Tech, and I'm here to present today our trial called Talking Health. It's a randomized controlled health literacy trial to reduce sugary beverage intake among adults. I'll mostly be talking to you today about the rationale and design of our study, but I also have some early process findings. We're currently in year 3 of our 5-year grant, so don't have a lot of findings, but I did want to expose you guys to some of the things that we're going to be exploring. And of course, I'd like to recognize our team up there who's been really instrumental in moving things forward for us. I also have no disclosures. So by the end of my talk today, really I hope that you'll be able to do 2 things. Number 1, describe how to incorporate health literacy concepts in the development, implementation, and evaluation of health behavior interventions, and also to be able to summarize how health literacy status and strategies may influence program participation rates. So what is health literacy and nutrition literacy, and why does it matter? I don't need to spend a lot of time with this because Elena just did a really nice job summarizing the literature. But we do know that health literacy has consistently been linked with less access to healthcare services and to poor health outcomes, and also with less access to healthcare information. I do, however, want to follow up on Elaine and identify just a few additional gaps in the health literacy literature. Relative to clinical outcomes, there are substantially fewer papers or interventions that focused on health promotion and health prevention behaviors, and most notably diet and physical activity. Another review that we conducted in 2012 also found that there's insufficient information to conclude if health literacy interventions can be generalized outside of the clinical setting. The majority of work right now is limited to the clinical setting. We don't see a lot of community-based interventions or trials. We also don't know if these trials can attract the target population. Most notably, can we attract low health literate participants into research trials? Right now, we know that about 30% of participants in health literacy trials have low health literacy skills. So is that adequate? Is that sufficient? Is there a way that we can reach more of those? And also, we don't know if we can really achieve an effect that is sustainable. And this is an issue across all health behavior research. We just don't have a lot of data on maintenance beyond the end of the intervention. We also don't know a whole lot about how engagement and effects may vary by health literacy levels. We're beginning to develop this body of literature related to health literacy interventions, and then oftentimes what we see published is the population published as an aggregate, and it's not really knowing how health literacy might moderate how people are engaging in the intervention or how their effects may vary based on their health literacy status. And finally, I have up here lack of theory. What we found in the literature is that we have a lot of health communication experts doing a lot of great things in the context of health literacy. And then we also have a lot of behavioral scientists who are using a lot of behavioral theory to also try to develop and implement interventions. And those two worlds, those two bodies of researchers aren't really communicating or talking or integrating their work as much as we'd like to see. So we need to see more of this integration between concepts and the health communication theory with other concepts in health behavior theory. So switching gears a little bit, Americans drink how much sugar-sweetened beverages? The short answer is they drink too much. The short answer is probably that they really drink way too much. I'm not going to present all the epi data on sugar-sweetened beverages, but most of you guys know by this point over the past 3 to 5 years that sugar-sweetened beverages have really emerged as a huge public health concern. On average, Americans consume about 10% of their daily calories from sugar-sweetened beverage intake. And we know some of the health consequences that can be associated with that. In the region where I do work, which is in the rural region of Southwest Virginia, we find on average people drink drink the equivalent of about 4 cans of soda per day. One of our prior studies had found that health literacy is a stronger predictor of sugar-sweetened beverage intake as compared to all other demographic factors. So we really took this key finding to help substantiate and build a rationale for the study that I'm going to present. You might be asking, well, why are you focusing on individual level behaviors with health literacy? And the reality, what we know is that it's great, and I'm very supportive of all these environmental and policy level things that are coming out related to sugar-sweetened beverages. And at the end of the day, those alone probably won't be enough, as depicted in our graphic here of the New York ban on oversized beverages, right? If you don't teach people the behavioral skills, they find a way oftentimes around those policies and environmental changes. So we also need evidence-based behavioral interventions, especially those that can reach and address the needs of low income and low literate audiences, and those that can be implemented and sustained in a real world setting. So before I jump into my primary aim slide, I just briefly want to provide a little bit of background on pragmatic trials and the REAIM framework, because we use both of these bodies of literature to also form a rationale for our study. A pragmatic trial is one in which the hypothesis and study design are developed specifically to answer the questions faced by decision makers. Really, the ultimate goal is to help speed the translation into practice. The pragmatic trial really begins to question the hierarchy of research design that we're often taught in our research methods class. And then the REAIM planning and evaluative framework also helps to balance internal and external validity and can heighten the likelihood of translation into practice. And REAIM, for those of you that aren't familiar, stands for reach, effectiveness, adoption, implementation, and maintenance. And both of these concepts also help guide the development of the work that we have ongoing. So, Talking Health, the primary aim of our trial is to look at the effectiveness of Sip Smarter, which is an intervention that we've developed, the effectiveness of Sip Smarter at decreasing sugar-sweetened beverage consumption as compared to a matched contact control group. And then our secondary aims follow what you might expect if one is using the REAIM planning framework. But we're also looking at reach of our intervention, including representativeness. We're looking at adoption feasibility. We're looking at implementation, including cost. And we also have a maintenance phase of our intervention as well, where we're looking at effects 12 months after our intervention has officially ended. So with Talking Health, Talking Health is a two-group matched contact randomized control trial. Each of the interventions are 6 months in duration, and each of the interventions have 3 small group sessions. They have 1 live TeachVac call, and I'll explain each of these a bit later. We have 11 interactive voice response calls. So each of the interventions were developed with concepts of health literacy in mind. The Sip Smarter arm targets sugar-sweetened beverage intake, and the Move More arm targets physical activity behavior. So we don't have, in some aspects, a true control group that's not getting anything, but our primary outcome is sugar-sweetened beverage intake. So our Move More arm serves as a control in that aspect. Okay, so this is there's a lot going on in this slide, but this is sort of the snapshot picture of how we framed our study according to the REAIM framework. And along the right, you can see some of those REAIM issues and critical considerations that we thought about in the design of our trial. And I think with this slide, really the biggest thing that I want to highlight is the gray boxes. It's those gray boxes that oftentimes we don't see reported in the literature, and it's those gray boxes that, if you have an interest in health literacy, we should really be concerned about, right? Because are the participants with low health literacy skills less likely to enroll in your trial? Are they less likely to engage in your trial? Are they less likely to follow through and to sustain some of the intervention effects? And I'll kind of march through each of these coming up as well. So I spoke a little bit in the beginning about the integration of concepts in health communication and health behavior theory, and many of you may recognize the white boxes as a theory of planned behavior, and that is the health behavior theory that we've used to ground all of our work. But we've added to that by also thinking about these health communication concepts as well. And specifically in our intervention, we target health literacy pretty globally, but we also, in the context of nutrition and physical activity, we specifically target numeracy and media literacy as well. And so we're really interested in trying to understand these causal pathways around how health and media literacy may interact with some of the things that we know related to the theory of planned behavior. We've done quite a bit of work related to the theory of planned behavior and how that influences sugar-sweetened beverage intake. And I mostly just, I'm going to flash these up here really quickly. And the main message that I want to get across on this slide is that these preliminary studies, these formative studies, really helped us develop the content and the messaging that we needed to make sure that we were going in with a culturally appropriate messages and culturally appropriate educational opportunities and experiences for the participants that we were going to recruit. So we didn't dream the study up overnight and pull it together. There was a lot of formative work that went into the front end of trying to build this intervention. As I mentioned before, our primary outcome is effectiveness. Our primary outcome is sugar-sweetened beverage behaviors, but with our pragmatic trial design, we also have physical activity behaviors as the primary outcome in our Move More. So it'll be interesting as we move forward and try to publish this trial, exactly what sort of approach we take in publishing that. But we're also looking at a variety of secondary outcomes, all the theory of planned behavior variables. We're looking at health literacy. We use the newest vital sign. We use a measure of numeracy. We use a measure of media literacy, and we also do the realm. We are looking at height and weight, blood pressure, and a variety of biological measures such as lipids and glucose as well. We also have a pretty comprehensive process and summative evaluation strategy. We're tracking completion of calls. We're tracking completion of the teach-back call and the IVR calls. We have a summative evaluation at 6 months where we're asking participants to provide feedback related to different perceptions of the intervention, both on a Likert scale and qualitatively. I know our measures might look overwhelming. All of this stuff is interview administered, so we've really tried to strip down any sort of literacy burden or literacy demands on our participants. So keep that in mind, too, as I'm presenting all of this. Who is it that we're actually targeting? We have an 11 to 14 county region in Southwest Virginia. Our targeted sample size is 340. We've used a variety of strategies targeting low-resourced individuals. We know that our best efforts are in some of that active recruiting. And when I say active, I just mean that someone is actually approaching someone and individually introducing the study to them. And we've built a variety of partnerships with the Cooperative Extension, different health departments, the free clinics and federally qualified health centers, daycare, shopping centers, food pantries, any other community event. We really just make all efforts to try to reach low-resourced individuals, and we advertise with flyers and mailed postcards as well. In terms of our inclusion criteria, health literacy is not an inclusion or exclusion criteria. That's something our team struggled a lot with. You don't see many studies that are actually building health literacy as an inclusion-exclusion criteria. And we can talk about some of the benefits and disadvantages of designing a trial to really enroll people of all literacy levels. So at this time, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the actual strategies that we use in these small group sessions and the teach-back call and the IVR calls. I know that there's a lot going on in this slide as well, but the main reason I put this slide up there is that for those of you that are interested in intervention development and implementation, there's a great textbook out there that's called Intervention Mapping, which really helps you map what your intervention strategies are, what your messages are, what your activities are, back to your guiding theory, and that's exactly what we tried to do. So with each of our classes, our teach-back calls, our IVR calls, we have very specific concepts or constructs related to our theory, as well as health literacy that we're trying to map to. So we had played all of this out and pilot tested this a good bit before actually launching it. So when it comes to actually delivering the intervention, In my mind, the very basics are some of the things that Elena just presented. Number one is that your staff is well-trained on clear communication techniques, and the CDC and AHRQ are probably two of the best examples to get the training for your staff that they need. At a very basic level, you need to make sure that the reading level of your printed materials is appropriate, and also that you have culturally appropriate messages and materials and approaches to reach your audiences. And I think that all of these things are necessary but not sufficient to really build a good health literacy intervention. Some of the additional things that we've done in terms of our group classes, I've already mentioned to you the underlying theory, but I can't overstate how important it is to make these things fun, right? Your interventions, your strategies, it has to be something that's engaging, that's tactile, that people are actually doing. So we've really tried hard to make sure that we're engaging our participants, that we have a lot of non-written activities, and that we have this observational learning as well. We try to minimize participant burden in terms of the actual literacy demands, but we haven't found a way to completely eliminate it, because we still need people to be able to fill out personalized action plans, and we still need people to be able to track their behaviors through diaries. So one way that we found to do this is to have a lot of extra hands in the room, but this is also another reason why we incorporate that teach back call, is to make sure that people felt comfortable filling out their drink diaries and doing some of the numeracy activities that our intervention demanded. So many of you might be familiar with the teach back method, or the teach to goal method. This is just an opportunity for your participants or your subjects to recall key concepts. Most notably, the teach back methods have been occur in one-on-one clinical settings where you as the provider or the physician or the dietitian are asking someone to recall key concepts. But doing this, did that just go off? I guess my ears just popped. Sorry. But doing this in a group session where you have 8 or 10 people in a room and having an opportunity to do teach back is a little bit more complicated. And we actually see very few studies that have empirically tested the effectiveness of teach back approach. But in our study design, 1 week after the first class is delivered, we actually call the participants back on the phone and give them an opportunity to recall key concepts. So we use a very structured script to do that. So we ask them 5 questions if they're in the Sip Smarter arm, or 8 if they're in the Move More arm. They recall those concepts. Those that they get wrong, we teach those concepts to them again, and they get 2 additional opportunities to teach those concepts back to us. And it's the very basic stuff. What is the recommendation for sugary beverage? What are the health benefits of reducing sugary beverage intake? So really, we built those questions off of the learning objectives that we'd hope to accomplish. And then finally, we have interactive voice response technology. One of the issues with trying to integrate technology into low socioeconomic populations is that those of you that work in those populations know that the digital divide is a really real thing, and that a lot of people still don't have computers or internet in their home. So we have to be cautious about how is it that we can use technology and use it effectively. The one thing that we have found is that most all of our participants have phones, and so we've really tried to advance what we can do with interactive voice response as a way to make these interventions more scalable. It's also a way to provide a good feedback mechanism in a non-written format for these participants, because they're interacting with their phone and getting a lot of personalized strategies. And so our intervention has a total of 11 IVR calls that are integrated in between all of the small group classes. Okay, I do want to stress that I'm going to present some of our early findings, and these are very preliminary. Like I said, we're in year 3 right now of our grant. We are right now recruiting the 7th of our 8 cohorts, but only 4 of our cohorts are through the 6-month phase. So don't hold me accountable to any of this data if you see it published, because likely it will change because it's not our full sample. But I think it is helpful for me just to present some of the things that we're trying to look at. And this first is this idea of reach and representativeness. So far, we screened 731 participants, 435 have been eligible, and 224 have been enrolled. And one of the things with using the REAIM framework and thinking about reach and representativeness is that we become very interested in those people who were eligible but did not enroll, right? How do they look different from the participants who actually enrolled? Was their health literacy level different? And so that's one of the questions that we're trying to answer. And it's also looking at, among those eligible, how do they also relate to the broader demographics of the region in terms of the census data? Are they representative of the population we're trying to target? And so here's the regular demographics that you might see in any standard paper, but our participants are majority female, majority white, about 30% have less than a high school education, about 65% less than $25,000 per year. And we're right at about what the national average is when you look at the systematic reviews on the proportion of participants that we're recruiting with low health literacy skills, right at about 30%. One of the things that we're interested, though, is thinking about how our demographics look compared to the region and specifically compared to Census Bureau data. This slide can be a little bit confusing, and I apologize, I don't have a pointer. But what the blue bars are telling us is that with our talking health data, we're enrolling a higher proportion of females as compared to U.S. Census Bureau data. Those of you that do behavioral interventions, this is not news to you. It's typically easier for us to recruit women into these studies than men. The pink bar is the percent Caucasian. You might think that, wow, you have a very large Caucasian population enrolled in your study, but the reality is that's what our region looks like. It's a primarily Caucasian population. The yellow bars are education status. Right now, our talking health data has about 35% of those with less than a high school education, and that's compared to the Euro census that averages about 55% with less than a high school education. So we're actually not happy with this yellow bar, this gold bar. One of the things that we think is going on is that we're not really, we don't have strategic efforts to target those who are over the age of 60. And we know that older individuals have a lower education status. So that's something that we have to resolve as we move forward when we look at our Census Bureau data. And then the brown bars is income. And on average, our income of our participants is about $25,000. Whereas the region is about $55,000. So we are enrolling a lower income population. I'm going to breeze through some of these rests because I'm coming up on the end of my time. Yeah. So I just pulled out one particular variable here, but we're looking at health literacy status, and what we know right now is that among the eligible and not enrolled in terms of health literacy status, there's no statistical difference between those who did enroll. So that's reassuring to us to know that our methods of recruitment, our methods of telling them about the study, informing them about what to expect, and doing the informed consent isn't turning folks away at the very beginning. So that's a little bit reassuring. In terms of intervention engagement, for all of these things, we're not only interested in differences between our two conditions, Sip Smarter and Move More, but we're also interested in intervention engagement between low health literate and high health literate participants. Right now, none of this stuff is statistically significant, but I did mark some of the trends. What you can see across the board is that the low health literate individuals, percentage-wise, are have a higher level engagement for class attendance, for completion of the teach-back calls, and for IVR completion rates. We're not necessarily proud that those numbers aren't even. We're just glad that it's not inversed, that the low health literacy aren't engaging at a lower level, because then we'd really be concerned about what's going on in our trial. Just briefly here, we've looked at the number of rounds of teach-back. So again, this top row here, the total number of rounds could be 3. And what we find here, what we would expect is that low health literate participants require a higher number of rounds of teach-back compared to low health literate clients. But The other thing that we found is that our Move More condition also requires a higher number of teach back. And one of the things that we're thinking might be going on is that with the Sip Smarter, they have to remember one number. They have to remember less than 8 ounces per day. And those in the physical activity condition, the physical activity recommendations, there's differences between cardio and strength and the number of minutes and the number of reps and the number of sets. So there's lots of different things that are maybe a little bit more complicated that's influencing some of those findings. And then also the proportion correct on the first round of teach back. So one would mean that they got 100% correct on the first round. And similar to the number of rounds of teach back, the low health literate participants get significantly fewer numbers correct on the first round of teach back. And the same holds true for the Move More condition as well. I'll just highlight one particular thing on this slide right here. We've looked at perceptions of intervention components. I just want to pull out the one that looks at perceptions of the IVR call, so the second row there, because a lot of times when you talk about IVR to stakeholders or to educators, they think, golly, my clients aren't going to like that. They're not going to like interacting with something that's automated or that's not personable. And the thing that we found that's really interesting is that our low health literate participants actually report a higher perception, a more positive perception of the IVR than the higher health literate participants. So it might be a strategy that we can think about advancing a little bit as we think about trying to reach and engage this population. And then here's my one little slide on effectiveness, and I've not done any of the moderation analysis by health literacy level like we hope to do in the future, but at least for now you can see that our preliminary effects are looking pretty good. On average, the 0 to 6 month change in Sip Smarter is a decrease of about 380 calories worth of sugary beverages compared to about 47 in our Move More condition, and that's just 100 participants, so we hope to about triple that sample size. So in conclusion, I hope that you've maybe got a little bit of information about thinking about how to incorporate theory and health literacy concepts into your interventions, that maybe you think a little bit more about the reach and engagement of the health literacy interventions that you're developing, because this will truly affect the generalizability of your findings. And I hope that you'll stay tuned for our outcomes as they come out, hopefully, in the upcoming years. So here's our awesome team that I recognized in the beginning as well. And I will take questions at the end. And I was about 5 minutes over. Okay. Thank you.